Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours. Hello all, and thank you for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by specifically thanking all those out there that reached out during our brief run-in with censorship, as so many in the independent media have been dealing with. We've been lucky thus far to not deal with it that much outside of YouTube in general. But there have been a few that have had the same kind of thing we've been dealing with in regard to their websites, not just their YouTube channels, which is a big deal. And I wanted to say a special thank you to all the donations and the new additions to our Patreon account, and just especially to those that reached out with kind words of encouragement and really, you know, kept me going through it all and letting us know how important you feel what we're doing truly is. And it meant a lot to me. So a special thank you to all of you. I haven't done a daily wrap-up for a couple days. I've been focusing on some interviews. One I just did yesterday with Vanessa Beely, which I highly recommend you check out. It was a very important interview, as well as an upcoming one we have on the 15th tomorrow with Aaron Elizabeth, a follow-up to our coverage of the holistic doctors, the deaths and the disappearances and all that around that in general. The interview with Vanessa Beely is a very important one, and I feel that it's important for you guys to check out. It just came out yesterday, entitled Vanessa Beely Interview, the not-so-secret war in Yemen, and the true face of U.S. humanitarianism. It was an excellent interview, and it is being incredibly stifled and suppressed already. I'm getting anything from people telling me that the video simply is not showing up, to that they can't access it, to that it's just not there at all on the channel, which is nothing new. We've been seeing this kind of stuff for a long time. But I wanted to make sure you guys take a moment to reach out and check that interview out and support Vanessa Beely as well. A lot of important information about Yemen and just U.S. imperialism in general that I find to be very, very important. So before I get into some of the topics I'm trying to discuss from today, there's a couple of things from the interview in the last couple of days that I wanted to reiterate, as well as any of you that want to continue this conversation afterwards to discuss some of the other topics that I'm not going to get to in the daily wrap-up. Make sure you stay tuned on this channel because we're going to be doing a TLAV research and review, as always, for another couple hours following this interaction with the chat and so on. So the first couple of things I wanted to touch on to reiterate that I found to be incredibly important. This one's particular coming from ZeroHedge.com, entitled Guided Bomb Fragments at Site of Yemen's Bus Airstrike Trace Back to Lockheed Martin. Very, very important story that's not getting a lot of coverage outside of independent media. Interestingly, we're now seeing places like CNN, of all places, actually discussing what's going on in Yemen. And I attribute that to all of you and your efforts in spreading this information, forcing the mainstream media to actually cover what's going on. This recent bombing of the 50 children who died in Yemen, a bombing of a school bus by the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition, is a big deal. And it has forced the mainstream media to cover it. But now it's turning out that we're finding pieces of bomb fragments showing us that they trace back to Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics, which is really nothing new to a lot of us. We've seen this before. We know this is happening. We know the U.S. is directly funding Saudi Arabia, selling them arms and such. But for those that may not even agree that this is happening, this is a very important thing. These fragments were from a Mark 82 or MK82 bomb, which is jointly manufactured by Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics. Very clear connection to the United States government and the arms they're selling to Saudi Arabia. There's really not much, that you can say to deny that there's a connection there. And they try to make that seem not the case. Now, if you want more information on this specifically, as I said, we've talked about this a lot over the last couple of days, in depth in the recent interview with Vanessa Beely, I highly recommend you check out the articles on The Last American Vagabond, the Zero Hedge article here, which is in the show notes, or the interview with Vanessa Beely. Very, very much worthy of your time. Another quick note in an article that's coming from the last couple of days, coming from Whitney Webb, Mint Press News, always something I recommend you checking out. In the same vein, U.S. provided intelligence and bomb used in massacre of Yemeni schoolchildren. Same story, same concept, talking about the same bomb fragments that we've discussed. But the point she's making here in depth is the concept of the intelligence also used. So as the U.S. continues to try to distance themselves from this most horrific incident in a long line of horrific atrocities being carried out in Yemen at the hands of the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition, it's clear that they not only provided the bomb, as we've proven, but also helped in the intelligence, picking the targets, as she makes the clear point in this article. At worst case scenario, they handpick the target of the bomb, or of the school bus to be bombed. Best case scenario, they were aware that the bus was going to be bombed. Very clear, in their own admission, past information we've gone over in this show. Very clearly, the U.S. is involved in this, and that is a very big deal, and they are trying to distance themselves from it. Now, as a quote from her article that I'll read, and then we'll get into some stuff from today, Whitney Webb says, despite the fragments of U.S.-made munitions found at the strike site, the U.S. military has refused to acknowledge that the bomb used in the attack had been sold to the coalition by the United States. Again, despite photo proof and tangible people on the ground showing that it is an MK-82 bomb made by Lockheed Martin, denying that it was the one sold. The Army Major Josh, I think Jacques is how you say his name, a spokesman for the U.S. Central Command, told Vox that, quote, we may never know if the munitions used was the one that the U.S. sold to them. Which I don't even know what that means, saying that, well, that wasn't the bomb that we sold. They just used a different one. But we are selling them bombs. It's kind of playing semantics here. But we can very clearly show that it was a bomb made by Lockheed Martin. And she goes on asserting as his reason the fact that the U.S. military doesn't, quote, have a lot of people on the ground. Yet the U.S. does have an unspecified number of ground troops active in Yemen who were involved in with intelligence sharing and interrogations even. At UAE-run black site prisons, both of which are verified information. We've shown many times, not only has the U.S. tried to hide their active presence in Yemen, but also the intelligence sharing, which they recently were forced to admit, picking these locations that have been bombed and being a part of the interrogations being run at these horrifying black site prisons, which we've also touched on in the past. These horrifying prisons in Yemen being run by the UAE support with pictures of U.S. personnel on site, actual photographs of them being there, carrying out the most horrendous torture that I'm not even going to get into today. We've talked about in past shows, some of the worst things I've ever heard. And of course, we have people like Gina Haspel saying, no, we'll never allow, obviously the CIA, but saying, no, we won't ever allow that. And this is exactly why, because they're not doing it. They're overseeing it being done in a black site prison outside of U.S. jurisdiction. Commonplace U.S. intelligence dancing around the point. Horrifying stuff we're seeing here, people. So all this information, I highly recommend you dig into more. Again, check out the interview with Vanessa Beely, as it's very clearly being stifled, something they don't want you seeing. So make sure you check that out. It will be in the show notes. So let's get to the stories from today. Obviously related, as all of these tend to be. This story coming from the anti-media. Oh, actually, anti-media covered it. Original story coming from antiwar.com, entitled UN Report Estimates 20,000 to 30,000 ISIS Left in Iraq and Syria. Very relevant to a lot of the propaganda information flying around. So a new report from the United Nations on ISIS estimates that despite the defeat of the group in both Iraq and Syria, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 ISIS fighters remain in the two countries, roughly half of them in each. Having lost all towns and cities, ISIS has mostly sent its fighters into the deserts along the Iraq-Syria border. They are in Anbar province in Iraq and Deir ez-Zor province in Syria, where the deserts make it easy to cross back and forth at will. Interesting how this seems to be allowed. We've talked about this in the past, of these pockets of ISIS on these borders being allowed to exist by the largest military force in the world, as they claim to be focused on solely fighting ISIS. That's their only reason for being there, of course, is as they say. And then, oh, as we're here, I guess we have to take out Assad, who's an evil maniac killing his people, which is verifiably false. Interesting how they seem to be dancing back and forth at will, fighting the very people that the U.S. seems to actually be fighting, which is the Assad government. The UN report suggested that a lot of the leadership is being relocated to Afghanistan. Interesting, as Afghanistan continues to be this kind of back hub of the rise of these extremists, as the Taliban is now stronger in Afghanistan than it's ever been after 17 years of illegal occupation by the U.S. government. As the actual people, the popular movement there, do not agree with the forced government of the United States that's been put there and what they're trying to accomplish there. Growing opium to spread around the world and continuing to mine their resources. Constantly what we see everywhere else, these same kind of illegal occupations take place. And it says where they estimate several thousand ISIS are active in Afghanistan, mostly in eastern Afghanistan. In addition, the report suggested a few thousand ISIS are present in Libya, of all places. Interesting how these ISIS factions continue to run back to a safe haven in the very countries the U.S. has supposedly liberated. Liberated with spreading democracy, and all of a sudden these ISIS factions can run back to these same places and find safe haven. Interesting how that seems to work out. The report noted ISIS has shown, quote, great resilience, that more greater resilience than expected. And foreign fighters aren't as inclined to leave the group as was assumed. Instead, a lot of the foreign fighters are being diverted to Afghanistan, where ISIS appears to believe it has more favorable chances. We have to begin to recognize another thing we touched on in the recent interview. This is nothing new. This is nothing new. We've known for a very long time, from the admission of Hillary Clinton and other people, about the creation and funding and use of the Taliban, which became Al-Qaeda, which became ISIS, to fight the Russians. This is nothing new. A long time ago, we can see very clearly that this is how this stuff works. These factions of extremists are used, created, funded, put in place to create the justification to carry out the foreign policy that we've been seeing over the last 20 years, which has left a wake of destruction in all these countries supposedly being liberated by U.S. foreign policy. It's very, very, very obvious. We have to begin to recognize this stuff. And it's something we've talked about with the recent War Powers Act, the authorization for use of military force, which now literally outlines that they have the supposed legal authority to go in and attack any country where they deem there's an extremist presence, such as Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and so on. Very clearly, if we can see that they created, funded, and are urging these groups forward, now they can invade a country based on their presence. Seems pretty clear what's going on here. I'll leave that for you guys to come to your own conclusions as always. I think it's pretty clear how I feel about it, but the facts are all there on the table. Moving on to another story relating more to domestic policy coming from theantimedia.com. Incredibly important, something that's not very shocking, but still is worth spreading, entitled Exposed: How Google Still Tracks You, Even When the Location History is Turned Off. Who's also not very surprised by this? This is not something that shocked me at all, and I'll get into something more personal at the end of this particular part that I've shared in the past. It's this new investigation by Associated Press shows how iPhones and Android users' location data is still recorded even when they have been misled to believe that it isn't. Android and iPhone users, Google is not tracking their location data if they've turned off the location history on their devices. After all, Google support page says, quote, with location history off, the places you go are no longer stored. But a new Associated Press investigation showed how that's not really the case at all. Some Google apps still automatically collect users' location markers, information that can be used to benefit their supposed advertising revenue, which is always the scapegoat, for better user experience. Even though we see very clear government connections in all of these groups, social media, online, and other, anything technologically associated today has some back connection to the government, and they made sure that's the case. And the article goes on to say, to wit, Google stores a snapshot of where you are when you merely open its Maps app, something that we all use, not a downloadable app, something that's on your phone. We all use this, and simply when you open it, you are being tracked, regardless of how you turn anything else off. It says automatic daily weather updates on Android phones pinpoint roughly where you are, and some searches that have nothing to do with location, like chocolate chip cookies or kids' science kits, pinpoint your precise latitude and longitude, accurate to the square foot, and of course, save it to your Google account. Jonathan Mayer, a Princeton computer scientist and former chief technologist for the Federal Communications Commission's Enforcement Bureau, said that, quote, if you're going to allow users to turn off something called location history, then all the places where you maintain location history should be turned off. That seems like a pretty straightforward position to have. Seems like too much logic for what we're talking about today. I don't think this is very shocking to many of you, but the real reality here, the reality of what we're talking about is it goes well beyond apps as far as I'm concerned. We pointed this out many times in the past. I've talked about the fact that I don't have a phone plan. I simply use Wi-Fi through my iPhone, which is something you could all do. I don't pay for a phone plan. They make you think you need that. I use Wi-Fi wherever I go to use my phone still, even though that's the case. And even though I leave the house, I can still use my maps all the way to the location, even though it's turned off. I technically don't even have a connection to the phone plan, and yet I can use my maps that'll track it all the way to where I'm going. Interestingly enough, if I get somewhere without Wi-Fi and try to use the maps, it'd say, oh, no, can't do it, no Wi-Fi. But then ask yourself how it's able to track me the entire way regardless. The point is that it tracks you. Your phone as an object constantly tracks your location. And that's a fact, very easily verifiable. So regardless of the apps and all of this, the point is that this is these connections to government can't be denied. And whether we're talking about user experience or otherwise, it's being used for purposes that we can't even imagine. And on a side note that is directly related to this, something that's not new also that we've talked about, but this has been coming up more in the last couple days, this one coming from the Ron Paul report entitled, Why Does Facebook Use NATO to Help Censor Users? Now, again, this is nothing new. We've talked about this in the past. The use of the Atlantic Council, which is connected to NATO, which is what Facebook uses now to decide what is and what isn't supposed fake news, and then to censor. Knowing that the Atlantic Council is it's a government-funded program with extreme bias in regard to U.S. foreign policy, which is exactly why people like myself and others who speak the truth about what's going on overseas get actively censored and suppressed on YouTube. Or on Facebook and whatever else. We've talked about the anti-media, which is always a good example, while they've gone down from 500,000 a day to 12,000 a week on their Facebook reach because they talk about the same things. This isn't rocket science here. This is very clearly what they're doing. And these connections now between social media and direct government influence are no longer even being hidden from us. And they are using it to censor anti-establishment, anti-war speech. Well beyond the two-party paradigm, left and right. Anyone that challenges the government narrative is being suppressed. Those that go too far and get too much attention are outright being censored. Nothing new here. And I recommend you dig into all of this for yourself. Ron Paul and Daniel McAdams always have a very good conversation. I don't agree with everything that they have to say in their opinions, but I do think that they're very open-minded and have a lot of interesting things to say, in particular on this issue. So I recommend you check out that video, as well as some articles from Antimedia and Zero Hedge that have talked about the very same things. This is nothing new here. And this needs to wake us up from this stupor of thinking that we're all using these things for the betterment of humanity and somehow reaching each other and reaching across the world and sharing information as they track everything, censor what they don't want to get out, and keep you on a very specific track forward. That's the point, and we need to realize that. So moving on to the next story, another one that is a very horrifying topic coming from the freethoughtproject.com entitled Horrifying UN Report Details Widespread Child Rape by High-Level UN Employees. Again, also something that is not new. We've talked about this in the past. All these stories have new additions to them as of the last couple of days. Very much worthy of discussion. And I always ask, why with such a UN report, with a UN whistleblower, information we've been talking about for a year now, why is this story not being touched on by anyone in the mainstream media? Always an interesting thing to ask yourself. And I think we know why. A deeply disturbing report has finally been released by the United Nations detailing the rampant sexual exploitation of children by UN employees that is widespread through multiple countries. And as the article says, while pieces of the report were released previously, and we've covered many of them in the last American Vagabond, the full report detailing the scope and horrifying nature of the abuse was only just released in July. And yet, again, not a single word of this by the mainstream media. As Disobedient Media points out in a report, the publication of a summary version of the report caused a global furor in 2002, eventually leading to some policy changes. However, these efforts have proven woefully insufficient in light of ongoing scandals, including, but not limited to, the recent Oxfam debacle, which we've covered, the Zoe Zark scandal, allegations of a horrific sexual abuse in the Central African Republic by UN forces, and the Laura Silsby incident, which we've also covered in depth, where this woman, Laura Silsby, who's now changed her name to Laura Gaylor, who now somehow managed to work for a child alert system, was literally caught trafficking Haitian children across the border, and guess who of all people, Hillary Clinton, got her off. That's factual information you can research for yourself. All of these cases and many others occurred after the publication of the UNHCR report, pointing to one unsavory conclusion. Aid work is not a vehicle of charity, but is, in a very real sense, a cover for atrocity. And this is something Ben Swan's also done coverage of, how these charity groups and foreign aid groups are used as a cover to do pretty horrible things. some sexual, some just for finances, but horrible things nonetheless. It is a weapon, a blunt instrument of power that is wielded to exploit the most vulnerable populations in crisis around the world. We can now state that sentiment as fact, not opinion. And we have to consider this in the light of human trafficking, as we've talked about many times in the past. Possibly even consider the real stark reality that sometimes these conflict zones are created or even stoked to allow that to take place. As these human trafficking organizations and people involved are massive, huge, powerful, multinational. That's also a fact. And to think that they don't have influence over creating these conflicts or continuing them so to keep people moving and keep a cover for their operation is wildly naive and easily verifiable. According to the report, quote, agency workers from local and international NGOs as well as UN agencies are among the prime sexual exploiters of refugee children, often using the very humanitarian assistance and services intended to benefit refugees as a tool of exploitation. Male national staff were reported to trade humanitarian commodities and services, including medication, oil, bulgur wheat, plastic sheeting, education courses, skills training, school supplies, etc., in exchange for sex with girls under 18 years old. The practice appeared particularly pronounced in locations with significant and established aid programs. A dossier released by a former senior United Nations official revealed that the United Nations employees have carried out over 60,000 rapes in just the last decade. What's more, the dossier estimates that the organization currently employs at least 3,300 pedophiles. I'll repeat that. The organization currently employs at least 3,300 pedophiles, if not more, coming from the UN's own report. Let that sink in. Their own report acknowledges this. And guess what? Not a single person has been legally held accountable for any of the 60,000 rapes over the last decade or the current over 3,300 pedophiles currently working at the United Nations or for under the umbrella of the United Nations. Ask yourself why that is. The problem has gotten so out of hand that it prompted the former UN insider, Andrew McLeod, to blow the whistle and hand over this evidence to Britain's Department of International Development, the DFID, Secretary Priti Patel. If I'm saying that, I feel like I'm mispronouncing the name. It's P-R-I-T-I. But realize that this is a whistleblower inside the UN. This is a UN report. He leaked this information to the DFID, officials, the UN released this report, and no one's been held accountable, and this is still happening to this day. Now, according to McLeod, anyone who's attempted to blow the whistle on this horrifyingly rampant abuse is silenced or fired. Interesting that we talk about so many things in these mainstream media channels, but something like this, rampant over decades of horrifying acts by people in power, not a peep. It should really show us that there is something around this main topic specifically that does not get covered, and there's a reason for that. And we've covered this many times on this show. So one more reason to continue to spread this information and just simply ask yourself why. Why is that topic suppressed out of all the things we talk about? And realize also that anything that's actually suppressed usually has a reason for it, an agenda behind why it's kept from your attention. Moving on to the final story of the day and trying to finish with something positive today. And this is indeed a very positive story, not even with a subtle undernote of negativity. This is an absolutely positive story that I'm really happy to be reporting. And the following up from a previous story, again, entitled Bayer Shares Plunge by $12.5 billion After Monsanto Court Case. Hooray! Finally, we see some actual change happening. And guess what? It's because of you. It's because of the people and the reaction with your dollars to something that we can recognizably see is a action towards progress. The Monsanto being held accountable, finally, even for an amount that's not really that big a deal for them, is hurting the bottom line of the major company because people recognize that there's a problem there. And that is some fantastic news. So Bayer AG, the German multinational pharmaceutical and life sciences company, which we know now, we know has been merged with Monsanto recently, because Monsanto's name is the most hated name in the world, as far as I understand it. Clearly trying to get away from that coverage, but it's not very good, working very well, because everyone's very aware that Bayer is essentially now Monsanto, or both combined, as they both have pretty horrific background stories. We've talked about the fact that Bayer knowingly let out a blood coagulant drug that actually infected all these different people with HIV. That was covered by mainstream media. And no one really got in trouble. It's, whoops, it was an accident. Didn't mean to, of course. And it was a big deal. And there's plenty of other stuff we've talked about Monsanto. But this company is now in a panic after a huge share sell-off on Monday, yesterday, following the decision from a landmark legal case in San Francisco, which we've talked about many times, covered a lot on this channel specifically, that glyphosate-based weed killer Roundup causes cancer. Shouldn't be much of a shock to those that have been paying attention and all the other studies. But finally, somebody stands up. And as we talked about yesterday, the judge ordered Monsanto to pay $289 million in total to the former groundskeeper named Dwayne Johnson. Now, obviously, $289 million is really not that much for Monsanto. And as we pointed out, as far too many people covered this as an immediate success. Oh, they have to pay him, and that's not what's ultimately happening. Monsanto is going to keep this tied up in litigation for the next decade, and they won't see a dime of this money until this comes to fruition, which is why in this country, it's near impossible to actually overcome the massive corporate conglomerates to get something to happen, because they continue to keep this tied up in litigation. But that's what's happening. But as we said, even though that happened, we're now seeing this response from people recognizing there's a problem here. Now, Dwayne was the first person to take Monsanto to trial over allegations that the chemical sold under the Roundup brand causes cancer, the glyphosate specifically. But there's right now about 4,000 other people in the U.S. with claims in lawsuits that they were also sickened by Roundup. So this could be the beginning of something. We don't know for sure. I don't like to jump the gun. But to see them lose $12.5 billion after a huge plunge in their stock, it should recognize two things. One, that change is possible. It can happen. It is happening. We can see. And the second most important thing is that it's only possible when we all come together by accident or by intention and make a conscious choice to stop using our money to support groups just like this. How often have I said that? Vote with your money. The last real thing that they respect in this country in regard to our ability to change something. So if we can see past the two-party paradigm, the deception they force onto us, change is absolutely possible. Because as the populace, the masses, we outnumber them dramatically. And we can actually make some difference. And I don't mean by violence. I mean by actually changing things, by realizing that we have the power when we actually come together and stand on the same page. So a nice positive note to end on today. As always, make sure you check out the show notes below and all the independent sources. Make sure you check out my interview from yesterday. Keep your eyes peeled for my interview tomorrow with Aaron Elizabeth. And if you'd like to continue this conversation, stay tuned on this very channel, where we're going to be talking about all the other things I wasn't able to get to in this show that's already running a little long for what I like for the daily wrap-up. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.